This is episode 440 of Wheel Bearings. I am Sam Abuel-Samet from Telemetry.
I am Nicole Wakelin from Test Miles and Top Speed.
And I am Roberto Baldwin from SAE's Automotive Engineering Podcast, Extraordinaire. I haven't added that officially.
Not just extraordinary, but extraordinaire.
Extraordinaire.
Really special.
It's more high class.
We're SAE International, so you got to like, you know, you got to class it up.
Of course, yes.
Can't just be like, oh, it's a blue. No. Extraordinaire.
So what have you been driving this week, Nicole? At least what have you been driving that you can talk about yet?
Well, that I can talk about. I can't talk about some of it yet, but I can talk about this. I had the Ford F-250. Wait, let me just read the whole thing. 2025, gosh, this is blurry. 25 Ford F-250 4x4 Crew Cab Platinum. It's like, it's four lines of description to tell me what the vehicle that I'm driving this week is. So basically, it's a big ass truck. I feel like that's that's what I've been driving this week. It's weird when we get super duty trucks like this, we get heavy duty trucks, because they're such use specific things. Like, you don't just buy this because you want a truck to haul your stuff from the Home Depot, or you want to, you know, go camping.
Well,
with
it depends
your
what stuff you're hauling from Home Depot.
Yeah, but I mean, like the average Joe, the average guy, not so much, right? I feel like this is the kind of thing you're truly doing this if you are doing work. Like you I don't know, you own a ranch, you own a plumbing company, you're an electrician, you got a lot of stuff you need.
My
to bring
uncle
around.
Has an F-250, and he has a ranch.
See, case in point, like it's a very specific
remembered.
Use case. So yes. Like, I get this and
hauling,
I'm thinking,
hauling
like,
horses and cattle with it.
Right. Like, I can drive around and I can see how it drives, but I don't get to use this the way Ford. I'm not the person Ford builds this for, and I don't have ready access to the things that would be for that person. Like, you know, if you put me in a sports car, I can drive on the highway and drive fast and have fun. What am I going to do? Like, I'm sorry, sir, can I borrow your horse trailer for a minute? Like, it's really weird. It's hard to, it's sort of hard to test these. So it is a great, big, huge, gigantic truck. And this has the, wait, let me get the my notes back up here. This has the 6.7 liter high output power stroke V8 turbo diesel, which is 500 horsepower and 1200 pound feet of torque. So it is made to do heavy work, 1200 pound feet of torque. This is the kind of thing you want if you have heavy duty towing that you're doing. It can tow up to the max tow rating with a gooseneck, fifth wheel, high, blah, 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 is 40,000 pounds. 40,000 pounds. So this is a work truck. This is a work
and
truck.
And I think even with even from the bumper hitch, it'll tow, you can tow like 20,000.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a truck for getting stuff done. So I don't get to tow and do that kind of stuff because I don't have a ranch or someone I can just say, let's go tow your horses around or something. So I don't get to test that.
In hindsight, they should have sent it to me, now that I think about it.
Yeah? Do you just have call horses?
My uncle. No, my uncle.
Oh, your uncle. Your uncle. I'm like,
he's only like
how
a 45 minutes.
Uncle?
Huh?
How far away is your uncle?
He's like 45 minutes away.
Okay, so yeah. They should have, so Ford, give this to Robbie so he can go to his uncle's place, hook up it to horse trailer, and tow some horses around. Just for him.
You know what you could have done is take the snowblower and blow all the snow into the bed of this truck, because that's probably going to be at least, you know, 1,000, maybe 1,500 pounds of snow.
It would
and
be
then
more
throw some
that.
Mulch on
so
top
much,
of that. Oh, and pick up some rocks.
So much snow right now. It's ridiculous the amount of snow we had. In fact, Russ was trying to clear the snow from the driveway and I had pulled this in. He's like, I can't even go around this. Can you put it in the road for a minute? I'm like, yes, I can. It is huge. But I mean, so that use case, if I can't speak to because I didn't get to do it. I mean, I've driven Ford at Ford programs where they let you do those things and it does do really well, but not something I get to test. So I'm basically just driving it day to day. This is the Platinum. So the inside is very fancy. It has all the things you could want. It has super cushy seats. It makes you feel like you're coddled, which I always
find.
Does
it have the lay
like,
flat seats in the front?
I don't know if they lay flat, but they do recline pretty good.
This is the supervisor's car. This is
a supervisor, right?
Or you got to get in and get it filthy if you, but all right. But this
the guy on the job site who's just the guy in the job site, he's not driving this. It's his boss or the person who owns the company. Or
the boss is telling everyone to hook it up and he's not getting out of the car.
He's not getting out of the car, right?
He's not getting dirty.
To get to that point, why it's not just the guy on the crew, the price of this vehicle all told, so this trim starts at $78,965. I had a chunk of options on this puppy, including the engine. So that 6.7 liter high output engine, that is $13,495. That adds to the price. So right there, you've added a huge amount. And then there's all the bits and pieces, the random stuff that they've added on. Total cost on this car, $109,545.
That is an expensive truck.
It's an expensive truck.
And my dad's house that he owns right now when he bought it was less than that.
Exactly, right? So what, you guys want to take a guess on destination?
18.
Well, depends on, you know, when this Monroney was printed.
Exactly.
If you went and bought one today, I know it would be $2,595.
Oh my gosh.
Well, then my Monroney must have been printed relatively recently because that's what I have as well, okay. $2,595.
Oh, I wasn't close at all.
Yeah. So this is an expensive proposition, and I don't talk about expensive, but it is a truck designed for people who truly like work on have a ranch, like your uncle. Well,
you'd be surprised how many people drive those things around as a daily driver.
Yeah,
it's Super Duty. I can see.
Yeah,
I've
seen people with Super Duties that are just like pristine, and they clearly have never been or done anything that Super Duty's built for. And it's like, okay, well, it's like when people buy a Lamborghini in L.A. and they drive the Lamborghini. I guess the job is for a Lamborghini to just show up at the club.
Right.
And so it's an Instagram car is what it is. And they don't ever have a chance or ever actually, you know, maybe in the middle of the night on the 405, they go like 90. But they don't ever do the Lamborghini things. It's to show off. That's the same thing with people who have the F-250, the Super Duty that they drive as their daily. It's a show off car. It's not do the thing that it's supposed to do.
If I wanted to show off for a truck, I wouldn't buy the Super Duty just because of its size. Like it is just physically very, very big. I would buy platinum with all the things on it. That has all the belt and it looks gorgeous, but you can park it. Like, okay, so there's a lot of snow on the ground right now in New Hampshire. Can I just tell you, trying to navigate like where it was two lanes and now it's more like 1 3/4, 1.5. Like, oh my gosh, I feel like I am so close to everything. And like trying to get into parking spaces and things, it is, you come around. It took me 10 tries to get into a parking space yesterday. I was pulling in and it was like, because it was a tight
like
spot.
Like Austin Powers when he's going back and forth in the hallway.
Like, oh my God, how many? And Russ is laughing at me and I was kind of like, stop. It is a big vehicle. This is a narrow spot and there's cars on both sides of it. So it is a bear to park that thing. And I know it would be way easier if you drove this all the time because you start to get a sense of how big the vehicle is and the clearance and all that. So any car you drive a lot is easier to park.
Suburbs.
Right. Or if you live in the middle of nowhere and you're just pulling into a big lot where there's not every parking space except the one you want is taken.
You
and
just
you can
take up
give
five.
Yourself a little room. Yeah. I should have just pulled up on the snowbank and then I would have been fine.
Here in Michigan, for example, a lot of people, have campers or they, have a boat, or they're towing their snowmobiles up north, and people are going up north on the weekends. So they are towing stuff here. And, if you're going up to the northern part of the Upper Peninsula, you're talking, 250 miles. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people, there's two. There's at least two people in my neighborhood that have fifth wheel campers, camper trailers that they tow. And so there's, they do get, proper, proper type of use. But I think in Texas, I think it's just the law that you must have at least one full size pickup truck in your garage.
You're not allowed to have
your
home.
Driveway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, actually, I think it has to be in your garage because I think everybody in Texas lives in a subdivision with an HOA, which, they all prohibit you parking a truck in your driveway. So you have to have a massive garage so you can fit your full-size truck
in. HOAs.
HOAs are just evil.
Don't get me started on HOAs.
You're saying, Sam, about where you live. There are people in our neighborhood that have F-250s and have, Super Duty trucks. And it is people who are towing because we have the White Mountains in New Hampshire. Everyone camps up there during the summer months. You have people bringing their trailers up there, bringing, you know, all the going camping, doing all their stuff. So there's people who really truly do use it. Like you see it. And I get it for the people who use it. I don't get this one for people who don't actually need all that towing capacity. Like, it's yourself an F-150. You'll actually be able to
big
go
truck,
into
Nicole,
space.
Come on. Vroom, vroom, big truck.
I know. Vroom, and I don't dislike it. I mean, it's great. I mean, flooring it on the highway. Like, I'm king, move it out of the way. Like, it goes. And it
yeah,
is
you'd be
so
surprised
big.
How fast those things are when they're unloaded.
It is yeah. really fast. It is incredibly yeah. fast. And, you know, even so, the thing is with things, when they're unloaded, when you have big trucks like this, they can also be really bouncy. Like, it can be miserable sometimes to drive something like this with no anything, just humans on board. This is pretty good because we have pretty crummy roads around here right now. Like, everything is it's February in New England. There's potholes and just, it's a mess. And it handles things pretty well. It wasn't super bouncy. Even when I was driving back and forth to Logan, it was, you know, you hit stuff and it did okay.
Were you actually able to get into the parking garage at Logan?
I did not get into that. I picked up ruts. Let's be clear. If I had, I don't think you could get a Super Duty. There's a part where you can pull in immediately. And before you get to the part where, like, you're going to take the roof off your vehicle, you take a really sharp right. And there's parking for larger size vehicles. And that's where I see all the, you know, the heavy duty trucks in there. But there's no, I'm not even doing that. If you think I'm going to drive it into a parking garage, you're insane. There's no way I'll do it. I don't care if there's parking. I'm not doing that. No, I dropped off Russ. I dropped him off, which means I just pull up to the curb and I pull right back out.
Get out. Yeah.
But and I'll tell you what, there's a tunnel. You go in through the Callahan Tunnel and out through the Sumner Tunnel, and there's tunnels. And suddenly that tunnel that feels really, really great on a normal day, I was like, oh my Lord.
Were you ducking down?
Oh, it's like you're hunching because you're like, I'm going to hit the wall. I'm going to hit the wall. And I'm looking at cars in front, like there's a tractor trailer, like great big tractor trailer in front of me. And I can see that he has space. I'm like, I'm bigger than that. In my head, I'm bigger than that. I'm going to hit the wall. It just feels so big. But
anytime the parking garage I use for the airport when I fly out of SFO, like there's room for, you know, trucks and SUVs. But anytime I have a large truck or SUV, I'm driving through it. I'm like ducking down. I slow down for the beams. And I'm just like, I know I'm okay. And then I look up and then I'm like, am that enough? And I'm like, well, it's like
foot. Have either of you ever hit a beam and not like hit it, but like been like, I think I'll make it. And you feel it tap the beam and have to back up?
No. Oh, gosh. That would be terrifying.
Usually the parking garage is, you know, at the entrance, they will have the thing
hanging
there.
Bollards or
right,
whatever.
Right, like hit the little thing, not the garage.
And yes, I have pulled in and touched one of those and realized, shit, got to back up. But that was with a van, like with a transit van.
Oh, yeah, it was in a full-size SUV that was like just gigantic, and I went to pull into a parking garage. It's not especially large, and a friend was waiting for me to go to pull in. And I hear it, you know, because I'm thinking, God, this could be close. And I hear it just tap. And I'm like, crap. So I back up. And she's like, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you pulling to the garage? I'm like, because the car won't fit. Like, we need another
too big.
Spot.
Too
it's
big.
Not the location.
I was helping my daughter move. And so I had borrowed a high roof transit van from Ford and trying to pull into the parking garage in her apartment building. It's like, got there. Could feel it tap. And it's like, oh, nope. Back up.
I have to
haul this stuff through the garage, yeah, unload it and haul it through the garage instead of pulling up right by her.
You could get those if you go to Harbor Freight, they have those furniture dollies. They're like $15 just for the future. So you could just put them on the floor and slide it through.
Well,
the garage.
I mean, we did have a furniture dolly, but still, you know, having to go up a couple of floors, you know, up the ramps.
If you ever need a furniture dolly, they're super cheap at Harbor Freight.
Okay.
I have a furniture dolly that's probably older than I am that somebody delivered a refrigerator to my parents' house, like 1978, and left this really heavy duty dolly. They never came and picked it up. My parents kept saying,
nice.
Like, guys, you left this. So then it went from my mom to me. So we had like this.
Oh, it's like a generational. It's like.
It's now a generation. It's like, it's what we're handing down. And because it was built in this.
Are you giving it to your daughters?
Who's going to get it? Rose?
Is that the wedding? Is that the wedding present?
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to put a big bow on it and give it to Rose. Like, here, honey, the dolly is now yours.
When you guys buy your house, you know, you're all set.
Yeah, the first one to buy a house gets the furniture dolly. That's the rule now.
It is. And it weighs about.
We're making rules for your family. Sorry, Nicole.
Yeah, it's super heavy, but man, it'll carry anything. So.
Yeah, my guess is that Harbor Freight furniture dolly will probably last like one moving job.
It's pretty sturdy. I mean, it's just two by fours and like casters. That's it. It's like the easiest
the casters,
thing.
Those are the one. That's what usually gives out, though.
They seem fine, and you can. I had a transforming dolly, like a hand truck that transformed into a floor dolly, and the casters died, and I just replaced those with some casters, and boom, ready to go.
Good to go.
Yeah, $15.
Yeah.
I use them all the time for ridiculous things because they're like stupid cheap, and they're easy to store. You just throw them in a corner.
Yeah. Awesome. Anything else on the F1 or the F250?
No, that's all I have to say about the F250.
Well, I mean, the one other reason why you might want to select the F250 over an F150, you know, is of course that diesel engine, because you can't get a diesel in the F150.
That's true. But you don't really need the diesel unless you're going to tow 40,000 pounds.
But, yeah. You know, you don't really need a full size pickup truck unless you're going to do that too. So, but people buy them anyway. So if you are going to buy such a vehicle, you might as well do it right and get the diesel.
Okay, fine. Everybody, just go buy yourself a $100,000 F-250 because it's cool.
The Duramax. Just always get the big, giant, biggest motor so you can haul something you'll never haul.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, let me tell you one quick story. I worked at a place once where someone wrote like 10 cars to what's the loading? Fifth wheels?
Yeah.
And three of the cars were SUVs. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Because they just looked at the numbers. The person didn't know what they were talking about. And so they were young and trying to write something, and they were just looking at the towing capacity. They didn't realize that what a fifth wheel was.
Oops.
Oopsie daisy.
Yeah. Good times.
All right. Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. We've updated the Wheel Bearings merch store, and now there's a whole bunch of new choices, new colors, new styles, t-shirts, sweatshirts, hoodies, hats, mugs, travel mugs, stickers, aprons, tote bags, you name it. You can get your Wheel Bearings merch at shop.wheelbearings.media. Go check it out. That's shop.wheelbearings.media. Robbie, you finally had something in your driveway this week that
I know,
wasn't
and
yours.
It doesn't even matter, to be honest.
Oh, come on. This is a very important vehicle in this brand's lineup.
It is. Oh, so I had the 2026 Corolla Cross Hybrid, which is it's a Corolla that's been raised off the ground. It's less fun than a regular Corolla, but it is what the people want.
Inexplicable reason.
People want crossovers, and Toyota's like, sure. And you know what? No issues. Gets good gas. What's it, 42 mpg? I got like 36, 38. I was like, ooh. And it's like just cruising down the highway. I had to drive down to Monterey for a thing with it. No problems. The steering's really light, so it feels like it's sort of sporty. It's not, but it kind of feels like for a little bit. I think I need a second car, or this is the car I give my kid, or this is like the college car, or, you know, you're getting older and you realize you don't have to haul kids around anymore and you just need a nice, inexpensive, efficient little crossover that's easy to get in and out. The Corolla Cross. That is really the selling point. It's good enough. It's a Toyota. It's going to last 100 miles. Whenever you stick your foot down on the accelerator,
even 100,000 miles,
it reminds you that it has a motor.
Oh, yes. Because it's a Toyota hybrid.
Because it's a Toyota hybrid. So he's like, yeah. It's like the saddest sound in the world. But you know what? Who cares? Hold on.
Aww.
42 combined miles per gallon. If I was driving around the city, which I didn't, I did a lot of freeway driving with this, I could have got up to 46, according to the EPA. So if you're just, you need a commuter car, you need whatever. Corolla Cross. Am I underselling the Corolla Cross? No, this is exactly what it is. Let's see. What's their starting
basic
price?
Basic compact crossover.
It is a basic compact crossover. Oh no, I lost the starting price.
For the XSE, it starts at $33,430.
Yeah, so that's the fancy one that I not only did I get it, so did Sam.
Yeah, I had the exact same one, same color, in cavalry blue.
What if we both had the Palisade the same week? You and me, Sam, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they gave us the exact same car. But, like, let's see. Okay, this is the sort of fancy one. It has wireless CarPlay. I'm sure it has wireless Android Auto. It has a wireless charger. You know, it's got all the little fancy bits and pieces. You don't need those, to be honest. Maybe wireless charging. I know most people like wireless charging. It's the Corolla Cross. What are you doing? You just want a nice, cheap car. It's like starts in the mid-20s. 26, I think. That's the information.
For the base gas version, it starts at 25,000 for the L trim.
All right.
The Hybrid S starts at 29,395. And the XSE is 33,430.
There you go. So you can get that.
That's the most expensive variant.
There you go. So like 30,000, you can get a hybrid. It'll get really good gas mileage. You probably don't need it. All you want to do is plug in your phone so you can see where you're going. It does have mapping. The infotainment system is fine.
My biggest complaint.
Well, like when you switch different, whenever I would switch to different modes, like from media to navigation, it was always like a little, it was like, hey, just hold on, man. You're driving a Corolla Cross. Chill. Yeah. And so it took a moment, but it wasn't like horrible. It's like when the Land Rovers and the Jaguars, when you push it, it has a sort of fade in and fade out. And you're never sure if that's a feature or a bug. Is it a latency thing or is it just they're using?
I think it's a bit of both because I think in that case it was they were using the animations to try to hide the latency.
Yeah. So Toyota's like, no, you got a Corolla Cross, man. Just it's going to take it's and it's not like, oh, my God, this takes forever. It's not like the Hummer. It's not like the ID4 where you push something and you're like, what is happening? It's just like a very subtle like just hold on.
Just a little bit of lag.
Just hold on, man. Hold on. We're driving a Corolla Cross. What are you doing? Settle down.
Now,
why isn't your phone plugged in? What's happening here?
My other main issue with the with that infotainment system, you know, because the interface on it is actually pretty good, except for the fact that, you know, the version that's in here, even on a 14-inch screen, it only shows or maybe it was a 12-inch screen in here. I can't remember. But you can only show one thing on the screen at a time. So you can't have a multi-pane view where you have your map and your media player controls side by side.
You get one or the other.
Yeah. So you have to toggle back and forth. The new generation system that's launching on the new RAV4, that one you can configure different stuff on the screen at the same time.
Those widgets.
But the other complaint I have about this system that I really noticed on the Corolla Cross that I don't recall having noticed previously on some of the other Toyotas I've driven recently, but on this one, the boot up time for the whole system from when you hit the start button until it's actually at a screen where you can do something is like 20, 30 seconds.
It takes a little like it's going to come up. It's like, hey, we're starting. It's like an old TV. You turn it on.
Yeah, yeah. Waiting for the electron beam gun to...
You had to hit accept, and you're like, you had to do the lawyer thing. Yeah. Lawyer said, we got to put this, and you're like, all right, that happens. If you just plug in your phone or you just have your phone, it'll just start playing the music before things start happening for the screens up. Like, you know what? Good enough. Let's go.
Except, you know, if you actually need directions to get somewhere, you know, then you got to wait for the map to come up.
Yeah, yeah, so. Give it a scooch. Wait a little bit. But yeah, it has a little speaker in the trunk, you know, for the kids. It's got the little JBL, like a little subwoofer. I don't know. Music sounded fine. Didn't sound any like it was, you know, any bassier than I would anticipate.
Yeah. And, you know, this year for 26, you know, they did a mild mid-cycle refresh, you know, so it's got a different grill, different front fascia on it. Looks pretty good. Yeah, you know, it's a decent looking little vehicle. You know, all-wheel drive hybrid, you know, which is handy in the wintertime. There's no drive shaft going to the rear axle. There's just a rear electric motor, at 196 horsepower. One difference from the Corolla, you know, it's the same basic hybrid system, but the Corolla sedan has a 1.8 liter engine and a little bit less power from the electric motor. This one's got the 2 liter and a little bit more electric power, but you know, it still has the same basic sound character of a of all Toyota hybrids.
Yeah, when you're driving. So
yeah,
it's, you know what, it's fine. It's quick enough to get around. That light steering is going to make everyone feel like they're having some fun. I love that they wrote on here under mechanical and performance, sport tuned suspension. I don't know what sport, maybe tennis. I don't know.
Polo,
maybe. Yeah. Chess is a sport, right?
Actually, you know what? Given the nature of this car, who the target market is, it's going to be pickleball.
Pickleball. It's got the pickleball suspension. The kids and the olds love the pickleball. Yeah, no, I drove it around. This is fine.
Yeah,
fine. That's the Corolla Cross.
Perfectly acceptable commuter car. It's going to run forever.
It's comfortable.
Yeah.
I drove like 2.5 hours to Monterey each way. Didn't feel like, oh gosh, my back, nothing. Nice and comfy. I wouldn't try to sit in the back if I were me, behind me. But if you and your friends are shorter than me, you can all.
Yeah, if you're under 6 foot, you're fine.
Plenty of cargo room. Mm-hmm. Open up to, that's pretty good. Plenty of cargo room. And what else?
It was still very cold here when I had it. And, you know, I did my fuel economy loop and only got about 34 miles per gallon with it. But, you know, that's
cold.
Yeah, it's cold. And, you know, snow on the ground, you know, all that nonsense.
18-inch wheels, so you have nice sidewall.
Yeah. You know, gonna survive some potholes.
Literally, you want something reasonable. You want something relatively inexpensive. You want something that's going to get pretty good gas mileage. You want something that's easier for you to get in and out of as you get older. Or you're young and you think you need an SUV for some weird reason. Corolla Cross. Bam.
It's a Corolla. That's all.
It's
all
a Corolla. That's the whole thing. It's a Toyota. It's going to last till the end of time. If you're going through college, it's going to last you all through college, and it's going to be your second car when you get your fantasy job. If you're like 1 year older than me, it's going to last until retirement.
Since the first Corolla appeared in the late 60s, Toyota has sold more Corolla branded vehicles than any other nameplate in history, and there's like almost 60 million Corollas have been sold.
Wow. All of them are still on the road.
I would say
a lot of them.
Well, most of the ones
a surprising amount.
Most of the ones prior to 1980, mechanically they could have still been on the road, but they've long since turned into iron oxide.
Yeah,
so it's just
frames rolling down the road.
You know, you look at them funny and they rust, but you know, anything since the mid 80s is a good chance it's still on the road.
Yeah, no, I still see a lot of like just Corollas everywhere, because they were never really like it was just like a commuter car. It was always like, oh, this is a good car. It was never really something like a Honda Civic or a Nissan Sentra in the 80s and 90s, where people were fixing them up and doing things to them that would eventually lead to the, you know, some of them not quite making it because of some of the work people did or racing them. No one's racing a Corolla. I mean, now you get a GR Corolla, which, by the way, is the funnest car on the road.
The funnest.
But the, yeah. Anyway, Corolla Cross. It's good. I was like driving around. I'm like, this is completely fine. If I needed a second car and I didn't, if I wasn't who I am and demanded fun from everything I drive, this would be fine.
So mine had some options on it. It had the convenience package with the tilt and slide moonroof and power lift gate for $1,250.
That's what I had.
And of course, you had the JBL audio. So that was 9 speakers, $800. The crossbars on the roof, door cell protectors, connected services, trial.
I don't think I had crossbars. There we go. That's the difference between our cars.
So mine came to a grand total of $37,524. Nicole, you want to guess at the destination charge?
$1,495.
Ooh, you're close.
Oh, wow.
$1,450.
Yeah.
What?
Mine was $37,339. I didn't have I had a two-tone exterior color and some carpet lifted floor mats. I don't know. I didn't have a crossbar, so I got hosed on that.
Yeah, I had the crossbars. Those are $330. So if you're gonna load anything on the roof, those are handy to have. You know, if you're gonna put a ski rack up there or something like that.
I know it's winter time in the North NorCal. Everyone's skiing or snowboarding right now.
Everyone is skiing here because it's massive vacation week. The kids have no school, so I was like driving less. I'm like, why is everybody going north? Why is traffic so congested? What? Everyone's going skiing.
Midwinter break week. All right. Anything else on the Corolla Cross?
When I would lock it, I think it thought there was something in the back seat. So it'd be like beep, 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 beep. It was like doing a little.
Did you leave Nico in there or something? Or
no, there was nothing in there. I don't know. Okay. It's just and I couldn't figure out how to turn off the lane keep assist for like ever, which is a pain in my butt.
All right, let's move on. First up, there was a story that I had in the rundown last week. I figured Robbie, you might want to maybe interested in talking about this one, so we left it.
Robbie's got thoughts.
3D printed pistons. This year, the bunch of new rules for Formula One. They changed up the engine rules. They changed up the chassis rules. One of the things they changed with the engines, it's still a 1.6 liter turbocharged V6 hybrid, but it's got a lot more electrical power now. But they reduced the power. They tried to reduce the power of the engines by reducing the maximum compression ratio from 18 to 1 to 16 to 1. But it seems like at least a couple of teams may have found a way around that to basically get more than 16 to 1 compression ratio. Because the problem with compression ratio, so for those who don't know, when a piston goes up and down in the cylinder, the compression ratio is the difference between the volume of the cylinder when the piston is at the bottom of the cylinder and when it's at the top. And the more you compress it, it heats up the air more, it can generate more power, more torque. Yeah, Robbie.
You're missing Robbie.
We're doing visual gags on the audio podcast.
The thing with the compression ratio is it's really hard to measure when the car is actually on the track, warmed up, driving fast. It's typically measured when the car is static. So you take a spark plug out, you stick a little thing in there, measures the volume, and as you turn the crankshaft, it measures how much it compresses. Well, the thing about, metal parts, or most parts, as they heat up, they have this tendency to expand. And so it turns out that the designers at Mercedes-Benz and at Ford Red Bull powertrains got a little creative. They figured out a way to use modern technology to make these engines have maybe a little more compression ratio than they're technically supposed to have, using 3D printed pistons. One of the things with 3D printing, and Robbie, this because you have a 3D printer and you print all kinds of stuff.
I print like all the time. It's a problem.
Yeah. One of the advantages that Ford was able to bring to Red Bull in their partnership for the new power units for Formula One for this year is their expertise with 3D printing metal parts. Most of what we think of when 3D printing is plastic stuff, but they can 3D print metal, and you can create these really complex structures with 3D printing. And depending on the nature of the structure, you can control how the part will expand as it heats up. And so they've created some structures that basically expand the piston, the top of the piston, upwards a little bit, so you get a little more compression ratio when the engine warms up.
So when you 3D print something, you have the exterior, the outside of it, but the inside is what's called infill. And so you can adjust like how thick the infill, like what the structure of the infill is. And if they've adjusted the structure of the infill, like towards the top of the piston, it allows it to, like you're saying, allows it to expand a little bit and get higher. That's where they're, I guess, cheating, but not cheating. I feel like every other team thinks they're cheating. How's that?
Yeah, it's violating the spirit of the rules.
Yeah,
but you know, I mean, the letter of the rules, you know, the rules say this is how we're going to, you know, this is what it should be. This is how we're going to test it. And you know, if you talk to any engineer working in motorsports, you know, the thing that they will tell you is when you start designing something, you have to read the rule book twice. The first time, you read it through to see, okay, what does it say? What does it say in here? The second time, you read it through and say, what does it not say?
Yeah.
And you have to find the things that they're not saying and say, aha, that's where I can get creative.
I feel like Honda, especially Honda with their engineering, Honda's a very conservative company, so I could see them like very much like trying to like, they got in trouble like at one point for something. So they're like, with racing, not just in like whatever. I feel like Honda could do this. Ferrari, maybe. Audi, yes. So if they wrote a letter to FIA, if the letter is just like, well, you know, this is the, then I can see Honda like, okay, you asked for it, buddy.
Yeah. I mean, back in the early 90s, when they actually it started in the late 80s, when they initially banned in-race refueling, you know, and they said, okay, here's the maximum amount of fuel you're allowed to have in your cars. And I think Honda was the first to do this. First, they started refrigerating the fuel to chill it down before they put it in the car. So, because what they do is they were measuring the volume of the fuel tank. Well, they figure, okay, well, if we chill the fuel, it's going to get more dense. So there's actually more fuel in that same volume. And so they chill the fuel and then fill the fuel tank. And then as it warms up, you know, you just get more, you know, more extra fuel, extra carbon. And then eventually at one point, they started getting more creative with the actual fuel. And, you know, this is something that everybody does now. Because now one of the other things they changed this year is they're using 100% sustainable fuel. So it's not petroleum-based. And so they've got all kinds of crazy formulas and chemical formulas for these fuels. But what Honda did in the early 90s is they were actually running their engines on toluene, like pure toluene, which is a really nasty chemical. And so the crew fueling the cars had to wear hazmat suits. They did that because it was combustible and it had more energy in it than traditional gasoline. So yeah,
I don't know a lot about racing, but I know that Honda was killing it. Absolutely yeah. Killing it for a few years. Like they were just unstoppable. And everyone's like, hey, and they're like, it's the rules.
Well, I mean, the last four, you know, prior to last year, like from 2021 to 2024, you know, the Red Bull, you know, Max Verstappen won the F1 Drivers Championship 4 years in a row, you know, using a Honda engine. So yeah, I mean, they know what they're doing. So these guys will figure out some creative ways to get around the restrictions.
But yeah, it's really interesting that they're using, you know, 3D printing, because again, you were saying a lot of people think, when you think 3D printing, people still think, oh, it's just plastic. But you know, Porsche and some other automakers have been using metal for stuff. And you know, no one's really using it outside of like a few little weird little parts for production vehicles. But for like custom builds and for to help like build things,
yeah.
This is one of the like, you know,
the parts to
put the parts in and prototyping. Yeah. And so it's really, we did a 3D printing, an additive printing podcast. You should listen to it. But one of the guys is like, everyone thinks, you know, they talk to these automakers and they're like, well, what can I do and put this in my car? And they're like, hold on. How can this help you build the car? How can you very quickly say, hey, how do we do this? And you're like, oh, we can just really quickly 3D print something. And then within 24 hours, 48 hours, we can have the problem solved of how we manufacture this part, how we fit this part in the car, how we do this thing. So it's really interesting. And it, you know, for racing, I mean, obviously this is such a short run. So it's not like, you know, you're not going to get 3D printed pistons in your car anytime soon as one.
Yeah, because you know, the thing with 3D printing is you can build stuff that you can't build by any other process, But the cycle time, the time to build a part
very long.
It's a lot longer than traditional manufacturing methods.
You can't press it. You can't cast it. It's just...
Yeah. I mean,
and with these things, these are probably taking a couple of days to print each.
Yeah. You're not building hundreds of thousands of these things or millions of them like you would for production programs.
Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway, good on them, I guess, for doing 3D printing and showing people what is potentially what you can do with it when you're cheating in racing, which is pretty much all racing, to be honest. All racing is figuring out how to cheat without actually cheating.
Yeah. All right. So do you guys know what creep torque is?
Whoa. Do not. I have no idea what creep torque is. Enlighten me.
Okay. So when in an internal combustion car with an automatic transmission, when you take your foot off the brake pedal, the car will start to creep forward a little bit. There's some creep torque. That's just the nature of how a torque converter automatic transmission works. So you've experienced that, right?
Right.
So with an EV, by default, an EV would not necessarily do that. But most manufacturers on their EVs, there's usually, a lot of them have strong regenerative braking, but they often give drivers the option. And you had this on your, on the Swagoneer, where, you could go to low regen and you could enable, creep torque. So it behaved like a traditional automatic transmission, at least if your 12-volt battery wasn't dead. apparently Fast got a little aggressive with the creep torque on the VF8.
It just takes off?
Yeah. Kyle Connor.
Yikes.
When they did that, $249 a month lease deal on the VF8 a couple years ago, he picked one up. So they've been testing it again recently. And, they found that the creep torque was a little bit too aggressive. And there's a video here in the show notes. You can see they had this thing.
Hold on. I want to stop you really quick. The video in the show notes is of corgis. The link you gave us is of corgis. Oh.
Wrong video.
Which is the most on brand thing you've ever sent us.
Sorry. This is from
because I was looking for it. I'm like, where's this video? And I kept like clicking on it and I'm like, oh, there's some video of corgis. Oh, we're gonna talk about corgis later.
It's the Pembroke Welsh Corgis breed judging for 2026.
Yeah.
I'm watching it now. I mean, this is cool, but let's watch this
while we talk about creek torque.
Yeah, I'm gonna watch the corgis while you explain.
Okay. Well, anyway. What happened was they took the VF8 and they put it on a grassy hill, snowy grassy hill, and they just took their foot off the brake pedal. I mean, typically, with an automatic transmission, in a situation like this, it should probably just sit there, if not even roll back a little bit. It shouldn't start climbing up. This thing started climbing up, got to like 11 miles an hour without touching the accelerator pedal.
That's not right. Well, so here's the fun the flip side of that. It was when I had when we did the drive program for that vehicle. Mine didn't have creep torque at all. It had zero. It had no stop, and it just would roll back. If I lifted, like before I could put my foot on the brake, it would just roll backwards. I was like, oh, I'm gonna die.
I just remember that's the only time I've driven that I've well and truly made myself car sick driving a car because it was so.
Yeah, it was like 80% done. And then they told us at the event that the better ones were being delivered in San Francisco, which I'm like, so you made me fly from San Francisco to San Diego to drive a car to tell me that a better version of the car is being delivered like down the street from my house. Because like near my house is where they store all the cars with all these Subarus and whatnot, like over by the bay. And then the cars, every car had something different that was wrong with it.
Yeah, it was like every one broke, but no two broke in the same way.
Yeah,
we're getting to the
all
like,
this.
The,
yeah,
it was like the coffee stop where we normally swap drivers or whatever. But it was like the coffee stop, and like there were cars just there. I'm like, where are the people? Like, oh, their car broke. What happened? Well, theirs won't go. Theirs has no, data here. Theirs, this one has this. And I'm like, okay, I'm just going to keep, I'm not going to turn mine off. I'm good on the coffee. I'm just going to keep going so I get back where I need to be.
Yeah, it was very, And yet, after all this, if the VF3 comes to the United States, I'm going to buy that stupid little electric Jimny. It's essentially just electric Jimny. You can tell me all the bad things. Again, it's like the Wrangler. You can tell me all the bad things that a Wrangler is, and I still want a Wrangler. It's like all old right dudes and Harleys.
Well, I put the right link in there. I put the right link in there now. So.
Well, I don't care about the right link. I want to watch. I'm watching dogs. Yeah. I was like scrolling through it while you're like, I'm like, oh, look at all the puppies.
Yeah, I was watching the group breed judging for the Pembroke Welsh Corgis.
Really. It's the corgi little, butts. I'm watching them get them little... all perfectly lined up, and I have multiple corgi butts in my view right now. Corgi butts are just, they have the cutest little butts.
Yeah.
They got little purple background. So you got to put this in the show notes at least because we're talking about it.
We need to put a link
it.
To this so people too can just enjoy a moment of
well, yeah, just some of nice
zen and watch
dogs.
The little corgis.
Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay, now you got to walk. Mm-hmm. There's a woman. And the little dog's running. He's like, hey, I'm a little.
He's like, so
oh, he saw a little treat or something on the ground. He's like, what's that? Oh, he's got a little happy face, one little ears down. Aw.
Well, this is the one he's examining. I always wonder when they examine the dogs. It feels like they squeeze. And I'm just going to say, they squeeze some personal parts. So I'm like, how can the dog just sit there and be happy when they're squeezing all the bits? I would not be happy if I was a dog. But yet,
don't kink shame the dog, Nicole.
What?
Don't kink shame the dogs. Anyway, corgis. There's little butts shaking back and forth.
They're really cute.
And also Kyle did something, I guess.
The most mistake I have ever made in the show, and Nicole and Roberto will not stop talking about dogs. It's your fault, Sam. Yeah.
All right, I'm watching the thing.
I love corgis. I got two of them. They're great dogs, except for when they're being jerks.
I mean, that's all dogs.
They're great, except when they're not.
All right, let's move on. This week, Ferrari announced the name of their upcoming electric car, which is going to be a 4-seater GT. It's called Luce, and they showed off some of the interior stuff. Apparently, they worked with Johnny Ive and his buddy Mark Newsom to design this. What do you think? Do you have a chance to look at this yet?
I've already said it. This is just Johnny Ive chasing that iPhone 4 high that he had because it was like the best looking iPhone. It's fine. It just looks like an iPhone 4. I don't know.
Well,
I'm okay.
Except that where the iPhone 4 and all other iPhones were
phones?
Well, touchscreens.
Yeah.
Touchscreen here. It's got physical controls.
I mean, I'm giving them hot props for that.
Yes, I'll give props for physical controls. But I like a touchscreen. As long as it's not the rotary dial controller and the Mazda, I will give no props for that.
So, yeah, I mean, there's toggle switches and buttons and rotary dials and all kinds of stuff on here.
I mean, it looks cool. It looks sleekly updated. Like, there's all this stuff in there, but it's not an overwhelming. Like, they did a really nice, sleek look to it, despite the amount of stuff they have included in this.
One thing I thought was interesting in the instrument cluster, you've got three dials on there, and they're OLED displays, but there's, like, a glass lens in front of them, which gives them more, almost look mechanical. And when you watch the video and you see it panning across, you can see how it gets kind of distorted when you're looking at it from the side because there's an optical lens in front of the OLED display. And then on the center screen on the center display area in the upper right corner, there's a dial there, which normally is a clock, and it's got physical hands on it. But depending on what mode you're in, what drive mode you're in, it can switch from a physical clock to a stopwatch, to a chronometer. And as you switch modes, depending on which mode it's in and what it's displaying, the hands will actually spin around and get into the right position for whatever, for a stopwatch. They'll start off at facing the top. It's kind of an interesting design.
Listen, Johnny Ive is my favorite Dieter Rams tribute designer. Design nerd humor. Hey, Dieter Ramsey did all the stuff for Braun.
Yeah.
All the cool Braun stuff that Apple sort of has, you know, from the, especially the iPhone 4 sort of used as a what do you call it?
Inspiration. Word.
Inspiration. Thank you. Line as an inspiration. yeah, it's all showing up in here, which I'm like, again, totally fine with, because Dieter Rams knew what he was doing when it came to design. I don't know anything else about Dieter Rams. If it turns out he's some horrible person, you don't have to tell me. I'll find out later in life and be disappointed.
All right. Toyota. I was out in Ojai, California this week for a few days with Toyota. And we got to drive a couple of cars, which we'll talk about next time. They did the global reveal of the 2027 Highlander. The current gen Highlander's been around for a while.
It feels like they just made this for Nicole. They're like, we heard about the we heard about the Wagoneer.
So we're giving you a Highlander EV instead.
It's electric this time. Exclusively electric.
I mean, does it feel weird that you're going exclusively EV where everybody else is like, oh dear God, EVs? Like, not me. I mean, like everyone's pulling back. Like, everybody.
Well, not everyone. Back. I mean, Hyundai's still like going forward and they're making money.
But, like,
I think what at some point you look at the market and you say, who's doing it wrong? And you see, like, oh yeah, these people are doing it wrong. These people are doing it wrong. These people are doing it right. And everyone is saying, how come you're not doing as well as these people? So I think it's a lot of not, you know, well, we can do that. I think that's what it comes down to.
Yeah. And, you know, from what I experienced last summer when I first drove the 2026 BZ without the 4X, I mean, they listened when we whined and complained about the original BZ4X. Mm-hmm. They fixed basically everything about that, you know, in the span of 2 years. And made it a much, much better vehicle. And, you know, a lot of the hardware, most of the hardware from that vehicle, from that update, has gone straight into this new Highlander. And so I think this could actually do reasonably well. A lot's going to depend on how they price it and they haven't announced pricing, but from what I'm hearing, it could be fairly aggressive, like, you know, cheaper than the IONIQ 9 or the Kia EV9.
My gosh, really?
Yeah. What do you think about the design, first of all, though?
It's the Prius design that we've all kind of like, oh, this is cool, that they've slapped on everything else. Yeah, I'm fine with it. It does kind of look like a minivan.
Yeah, I think it actually, I mean, it's got like that EV. I don't think it's anything surprising. I don't think it's especially out there. I think it's sort of typical of what a three-row EV sort of looks like, most of them, you know? It follows a sort of traditional lines and stays in line with Toyota's whole Prius thing. Like it's the Toyota-fied version. Yeah.
Yeah. You get the hammerhead headlights, as they call it, but you know, it's a boxier design than the last gen Highlander, and size wise, it's like 4-ish inches longer than the old Highlander, but about 4 inches shorter than the Grand Highlander. Okay. So it's roomier inside. And it's actually really nice inside, you know, complained a lot about, you know, some Toyotas in recent years that, you know, a lot of hard plastics, they feel kind of cheap. This does not feel that way.
Did you actually get to see the inside? Like, I know you didn't drive it, but you get to.
We sat in it. I shot a video that should be coming out early in the week on greencars.com, a walk around video with Tim Rippinger, who's the marketing manager for Highlander. And, you know, so we sat inside. It's really nice inside. It's a much more premium feeling vehicle.
Beautiful. That one interior shot you have that just shows like the dashboard and has the seat. It looks really good. Like that from the, but you don't know from images. So if you're seconding that it actually is as good as that picture looks, that's fantastic.
Yeah. And you know, the door handles on the outside are flush, but they're not retracting door handles. So there's like a pocket in there and you just stick your hand in there. There's a switch just on the inside.
Nice.
And so it pops open. It's a nice balance there. I think it's really well executed. It'll be front wheel drive as the base. There's two trim levels, the standard front wheel drive, And then all-wheel drive with the same motors that are on the BZ. So 221 horsepower, 338 horsepower. With the all-wheel drive, they say it'll do 0 to 60 in about 6 seconds, which is, you know, better than the current outgoing Highlander hybrid. 320 miles of range. So I think this could be a really interesting player in this segment.
This thing is a large vehicle doing over 3.3 to 3.7 miles per kilowatt hour. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. Toyota, with this Highlander, it's going to be electric only. But, they also have the Grand Highlander. And the thing that's happened since the Grand Highlander launched a couple of years ago is it actually took most of the sales of the current generation Highlander. As recently as like 2022, I think, the current gen Highlander sold almost 280,000 units. Last year it was down to 65,000, but that's because Grand Highlander sold like almost 150,000.
Yeah.
So total combined between them, you know, it hasn't really changed much, but everybody shifted to the bigger Grand Highlander. So this, you know, will give an electric option that's closer in size to that Grand Highlander size. And then, you know, there will probably be a Lexus version of this shown sometime later this year. goes on sale. Production starts in the fall. First ones should start hitting dealers before the end of the year, but really, you know, early in the new year is when they really intend to start selling these aggressively. And I think it could do okay.
There's definitely a hunger from people from the Honda and Toyota camp to, they want an EV, but they do not want to give up their Hondas and their Toyotas. I think the Prologue outselling the Blazer was a good example. It's the same car.
Yeah.
Essentially. The Honda put all their bits on top of it. But people, you know, they're like, well, I don't trust Hyundai because they remember something that happened 30 years ago. And you don't know what Ford's doing. And, you know, if you're a Honda Toyota person, you're definitely not going to buy a GM vehicle, even though if you bought a Prologue, you bought a GM vehicle. So I think that those, especially Toyota people. Toyota people are Toyota people who are Toyota people who are Toyota people. And they are diehards. And I see them like, well, I'm not going to get something until Toyota has something good. And I think with the BZ4X, when it first came out, they just sort of sidelined that car. It felt like they were like, I don't want to do this. I mean, I'll do it, but I'm not happy about it. And whenever you go to the auto show, it was always off in a corner somewhere. Whereas like Subaru, exact same car, had it front and center.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course they fixed all the issues with the BZ4X. And I think they were just like, oh, you know, if we're going to do it, let's do it right. Which again, for the entry level, it's like 3.7 miles per kilowatt hour for a 3-row SUV. It's front wheel drive, you know, you're not getting all wheel drive, but that's really good. And for the top end, it's 3.3 miles per kilowatt hour, which is still really good for a 3-row SUV. When you think about those numbers, think them as multiples of 10. So if it's 33.7, just think of it as 37 miles per gallon for this vehicle. If you think of it as 33 miles per gallon, like an equivalent of a gas car. So yeah, no, I'm happy that they Toyota is finally taking it seriously, and they're putting their Toyota, you know, magic on there. And I think Honda's doing the same thing with their Zero Series that's coming up. So yeah, I mean they. Again, I for years I kept saying Hyundai's doing what we thought Toyota and Honda would be doing by now, and now Toyota and Honda are catching up.
And this Highlander is going to be built in the U.S. It's built in Georgetown, Kentucky, where they build the current Highlander and the Grand Highlander. So, and the batteries are built here. So, it'll be interesting to watch. We should be getting first drive of this in the fall before it goes on sale, and I'm really interested in this one.
It won't be, but Akio won't be excited until he gets a solid state and a GR Corolla. That's the only time he's in.
Yeah.
He'll be like, oh yeah, it's something we got to do. And then the next week he'll be like, I don't even know electricity.
All right. Let's stick with 3-row SUVs for a moment, or crossovers. Volkswagen brought some folks to Montreal to sample the new 2027 Atlas and in the snow and ice near Montreal. Case from TFL got to go there. What do you think of, the shape, pretty much standard three-row SUV. I mean, this thing's wrapped in this very colorful camouflage, but, it looks to me like it's still an Atlas.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's, it's veered far from the Atlas.
It's still very Atlas-y. It's not one of those things you're going to look at and go, wow, that is dramatically different. And it's like, okay. Little changes here and there.
No, electric in this one, and not even a hybrid yet. It's still the same, or it's an updated version of the 2-liter turbo that's in the current gen Atlas, which actually, when I drove it in December during Operation Frodo, I was very impressed with it. It was really good.
Yeah, I think
it's a solid car. I just can't imagine it's going to change overly much. I actually weirdly love the camouflage thing.
I should offer that as an option.
Yeah, can we buy it like that? Then it looks
fabulous.
We
can't get the Harlequin package anymore. Remember
that? Yeah,
like,
and normally camouflage
colors?
Is, and people can't see it, it's normally black and white pattern they use to cover it up. And this is like a kaleidoscope of color. It looks like it should be in Miami or something. It's all these bright colors. It looks, but it's in snow. So
it's ready to party. Yeah, it's a good color, especially for show shoots. Sometimes they'll have us go out and we're like, hey, we're going to drive this car in the snow. And then it's gray. And you're like, come on, guys.
Or white.
Or white. Like, what were you thinking? We have to shoot video or photos of this.
All right. Back in 2021, Congress passed a bill called the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act that included several billion dollars to fund deployment of DC fast charging across the United States. And when the Department of Energy put together the rules for qualification for that money, there was a Buy America provision, which said that 55% of all the parts and material content in these chargers that got money through the NEVI program, it's the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program, or NEVI, had to be sourced in the United States. It took a while before, everybody got their supply chains lined up to build all this stuff domestically. And so that's, that was part of the reason why it took took a couple of years before we actually started seeing any NEVI-funded chargers being deployed. Well, last year, after the current administration took power in Washington, the guy in charge signed an executive order just arbitrarily saying, yeah, we're freezing this funding. We're not going to give out any more of this $5 billion that Congress appropriated. The way the Constitution's written, he's not allowed to do that.
Can't really do that. Congress already said the money's like, here, the money's for this thing. You can't just
the executive branch is responsible for spending the money that Congress appropriates. Well, several judges actually ruled that, nope, you can't do that. It's against the rules. So what they did was they changed the qualification rules to get NEVI funding. And they announced this week that instead of 55% American content, it had to be 100% American content, which effectively means that not another penny of this money is going to get spent.
Uh-huh. 100, because I don't think there's anything you can buy in this country that's 100% American content.
Right? I know. Is anything really 100%?
Maybe some agricultural products. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't even...
corn, wheat.
Actual food?
Not the hardware. Yeah, the food.
Okay.
You can get that domestically.
All right.
You can use domestic rainwater and, domestic soil and domestic seeds.
All right.
No Chinese rainwater
allowed. That is about it, really.
Yeah.
I'm literally looking at my desk at this, the mess that is my desk, and I cannot think of anything that's on here that would not have something from another country, even the tiniest little bit. I mean, even this little adapters
mug
probably
that was handmade in Vermont.
Oh, was it locally?
So yeah, but was it made
the
from
glaze?
American clay?
And the glaze?
I would imagine, because I can't read the little imprint, but it was at a pottery shop. So I think I'm pretty sure this is
maybe
potentially. This is all I got. All I got
That's
is
all
not
I got.
A
mug that might I got, I found a foxtail on my desk, because dogs. So this is the one thing on my desk is 100% sourced in the United States in my back from my backyard from earlier this year. Anything else I think is a little suspect.
All right. So the good part is that most of the deployment of DC fast chargers over the last couple of years has been done without NEVI funding anyway. And last year, 2025 was the biggest year yet for DC charging deployment. Now, there was more than 3,300 new DC fast charging stations deployed in the U.S. last year with almost 17,000 chargers. That process is continuing. And, I don't know that it's actually going to have, that this rule change is going to have that huge of an impact.
I mean, Tesla's not going to be happy about this. I can tell you that.
Too bad.
What are you going to do?
We talked the last couple of weeks, or talked recently about China having new rules that banned retracting door handles, electronic door handles on cars. They've got a couple more new rules coming out. They are banning steering wheel yokes or steering yokes.
Wow.
And they're also cracking down on what controls can be put into touchscreen interfaces. On the steering yokes, they're not actually explicitly banning yokes, but the way the rules are written, part of it is that for testing, when they do the crash testing, they test at various locations around the steering wheel to see how much force it takes to break it, things like that. And because if you can't do the test, you can't pass the test. And because the steering wheel yoke or steering yoke doesn't have the top part of the steering wheel, they can't test at those locations because there's nothing there.
Dun, dun, dun.
And so that will effectively ban those.
All steering wheel yokes need to be sourced 100% in China.
So they're going to ban those. On the screens, essential controls, things like turn signals, your transmission, your gear selection, and a few other things now must have physical controls. So
Yay.
Things like what Tesla has done with putting the gear selection on the screen, can't do that anymore. You got to have some sort of physical control.
Mm-hmm.
And wipers as well. Wipers is another one.
Yeah, so that was a hold.
All good things, I think.
Yeah. I want to be able to.
I think there's a place for getting things. The tech got ahead of itself, and this puts like no hold up.
I got yelled at for like 45 minutes by Tesla about my. I hadn't even written the article yet, but talking about wipers, because before, like, the wipers were automatic. Like, you had to go into the touchscreen to like, and they're like, well, you know, I'm like, they're like, well, you just don't know what you're talking. I'm like, I drive cars. That's my job to know about cars. And this is unsafe because they're like, well, when it rains, I'm like, it did rain while I had the car and it didn't turn the wipers on and the amount of time that I wanted them to. Like I couldn't see and the wipers hadn't come on. I'm like, yeah, but you know, the car is for the future. I'm like, I can't review a car.
But I have to drive it now. Not
exactly.
In the future.
I have to drive and review what I have now. Anyway, I've been yelled at a lot by Tesla.
We all.
But the PR people really liked me because I'd always say that it wasn't really a self-driving car and blah, blah, blah. Essentially, I would just say things that were true. And the PR people enjoyed that because it was less FUD that they had to deal with, where people were like, oh, it's self-driving. And they're like, no, it's not. We can't. Please stop saying that.
Please stop marketing it as such.
Yeah, I know. The PR and the marketing team were not on the same. We're not the same team, which is, sad. Whatever.
All right. Well, so it looks like China is going to be doing all the automotive regulation going forward, at least all the good automotive regulation.
Well, and when you think about it, like, because automakers, like the S-Class, before the unveil, months before, I went to Germany and I was talking, we were talking to Ola, CEO of Mercedes-Benz. And I asked point blank, what's the deal with the passenger side display because I've never been able to get anyone excited about that display. I get people in the car. I'm like, hey, look at that. And they're like, oh, that's kind of cool. And then they pick up their phones after a few minutes. And he was very frank. He's like, for Asia loves these displays. China especially really loves these displays. So, you know, they're building a global car. So when you're an automaker, you want to build a global car. You don't want to make it, you know, you don't want, especially now is, you know, you're looking at like,
especially it's your biggest market.
Yeah, especially when it's your biggest market. So we're getting, you know, what China has dictated, essentially, which, you know, the world's been getting what America's dictated for years. So, you know, it's fine. So we have a you know, passenger display in the S-Class because in China, passenger displays are a big deal.
All right. Well, that's all we've got on the list for this week. I did not go to San Diego to drive the new Mazda CX-5.
I did, but I can't talk about it yet.
Yeah, so that's still under embargo. But because I had no driving impressions of it, I did have a chance to talk with Tom Donnelly, who's the CEO of Mazda North American Operations. And we talked about, you know, about the brand and kind of what's going on. So, you know, I put this one up for patrons several days ago. Now the rest of you can listen to this. So have a listen to my conversation with Tom Donnelly about the future of Mazda. We will see you next time when Nicole can tell us about the CX-5.
Yes,
what
I
it
can
was like
share
to drive
about it.
And,
yes.
And I'll be able to tell you about what the Toyotas I drove this week were like. And you can also tell us about what the nearly identical Subaru versions were like. I suspect that Subaru will have a much more interesting off-road course for you to evaluate the
I
Trail
would think,
Seeker.
And it's supposed to rain. So it should
well,
get
we got,
more
we got a bunch of rain. Like the night before we drove, it rained an inch and a half in about 2 hours in Ojai, where I was.
So it made a mess?
Yeah. So we couldn't actually even do the off-road the next day. We had to wait a day before we could go off-road.
I feel like Subaru's going to find a way to get us off-road come heck or high water. So yeah, we'll do it.
I'm sure Jamie and John will have come up with a really interesting off-road course.
Yeah,
to really evaluate.
I'm going
to
wear my boots so I can get muddy.
Yeah. But that's all for next week. In the meantime, have a fun week, and I'm going to go get some sun.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. All right. And I am talking today with Tom Donnelly, who is the president and CEO of Mazda North America Operations. Is that correct?
Correct. You said that with a question mark at the end.
I always want to make sure, you know, never know, sometimes people's titles change and things like that. So just wanted to be certain of what your current title is as of today when we're recording on February 10th.
It is a dynamic industry. Yeah, I understand.
Yeah. Tom, good to talk to you. We'll start off with a little bit about what's going on with Mazda. It's been an interesting kind of shift for the brand over the last decade. You know, there's been kind of a repositioning of the brand to make it a little more premium than it used to be considered. It seems like that strategy of positioning the brand has definitely, it seems to me anyway, like it's worked. Your overall sales are up 38% over the last 10 years. The product mix has shifted significantly towards higher margin utility vehicles from some of the lower margin cars that you had before. When you first started down this path, models like the CX-5 seemed to get notably more expensive than some of their competitors. But what seems to have happened over the last several years is that essentially everybody's caught up on pricing. And now when you compare pricing, you're very competitive with the rest of the, you know, whichever segment you're looking at. In some cases, actually quite more than competitive. Mazda's, you know, when you compare a Mazda to a lot of the competitive vehicles, you get into it, it feels a lot more premium. You know, how do you see the Mazda brand continuing to evolve over the next 5, 10, 15 years?
Yeah, thanks for the question. There's a lot in there, but you hit a lot of high notes of, frankly, our strategy over the last 10 years. So if I go back to, you know, the point of reference that you originated your question with, when Morrison arrived in 2016, the introduction of brand value management, it was really about acknowledging where the brand was perceived or how the brand was perceived in the U.S. market and what we needed to do to strengthen the brand, strengthen our dealer partners' business, and really prepare ourselves for the introductions of some of the models that are now in the marketplace. So there was a very intentional, very deliberate 10-year plan that we've been executing. And you talked about the business results in terms of sales volume, you know, up nearly 40% in that time frame. If I bookend it and talk about, you know, a few years ago, we introduced CX-50, which was an all-new model for us in a segment that we already have our top volume model with CX-5. That's been transformative for us. We're approaching 100,000 new vehicle sales with CX-50. The introduction of our CX-90 and CX-70 has been a significant addition to our business as well. CX-90 outsells CX-9 2-to-1 from its preceding model. But you talked about the price points and where we are. There's a couple points I'd want to make there. If we back up to our strategy within the segments we compete in, it really comes down to two cornerstone elements. One is making sure that we're providing value for our owners, for our customers. And we do that in a number of different ways. The characteristics of our brand, so the craftsmanship, the quality, the driving dynamics, the things that Mazda is known for, the design. In addition to the suite of safety features that we have in our products. So we feel like we were providing a level up of content in our vehicles and providing value. The other thing that we did, and this speaks to your point about how we were priced previously, we were introducing powertrains that were new or unique to the segment, like turbo engines in $25,000 vehicles with Mazda 3, and CX-30 and CX-5 as well. So again, we were leveling up the powertrains and the content that we had. If you looked at a range within a segment, we were absolutely on par with the Hondas, the Toyotas, the Subarus that we compete and are most cross-shopped with. But we also had that next tier up based on the two things that I mentioned previously. And that has contributed to the business results that you referenced. What we've been able to achieve and how we carry that forward is when I think about the portfolio that we have now. I mean, we basically start at 25 and we go all the way up to 60,000. Well, you know, Sam, in the marketplace today where affordability is paramount and a significant challenge for U.S. consumers, when the average transaction price is north of 50, you know, to have that range of 25 to 60, and we're seeing solid business growth in both of those segments. You know, I've referenced earlier what we're seeing with our CX-90. Just recently, some of the transitions we've made with Mazda 3 of really trying to lean into that a little bit more. And now, you know, the point of the event that we're having here in Southern California with the introduction of the all-new CX-5, to have the strength that I referenced earlier with our top volume model being completely refreshed and what that will mean for our brand and allow our owners to move into this next generation of CX-5, we're really excited about what that represents for our brand and our business.
Yeah. So, you know, looking at the CX-5, you mentioned the CX-50 that you launched a couple of years ago. And, you know, these are two fairly similarly sized vehicles that you've got competing in the marketplace. Do you anticipate those models starting to diverge a little bit more in terms of kind of the nature of those vehicles? Like, for example, you know, CX-50, you know, a little more, you know, potentially making it a little more rugged, a little more off-road oriented than it is today. CX-5, a little more road oriented. You know, how do you see those two models, you know, as they coexist in the lineup evolving?
Yeah. So first of all, that segment is a massive business opportunity for the entire industry, but for us as a brand as well. And I think we've demonstrated over the last few years that we can succeed with both. So CX-5 continues to be our best-selling model, 120,000 to 130,000 vehicles, and we have every bit the same expectations with the new CX-5 as well. But since the introduction, CX-50 has grown double digits every year, year over year, and we're approaching 100,000 vehicle sales here in the U.S. also. So we see two very different consumers for that. You referenced the characteristics of the vehicles. You know, CX-50 does have a bit more of a rugged exterior and a different level of capability and utility. It's the proportions are different. The dimensions are a bit different. They compete in terms of this pricing in the same segment for sure. But what we've seen from a customer profile is two very distinct customers that are purchasing either CX-50 or CX-5. CX-50, perhaps not surprisingly, skews a bit more male. It's about 60-40, whereas CX-50 is more 50-50. CX-50 tends to be a little bit younger, a couple years or so. So we are seeing a different profile with each owner. And how we go to market is trying to position it, as you acknowledge, but also with different media channels and different approaches and different messages to how we succeed with both those models.
Okay. So with the new CX-5 that you're launching right now, what were some of the primary goals that you're trying to achieve in this vehicle? What did you want to improve on relative to the previous generation, which obviously is still a pretty strong seller?
Yeah, a lot has changed since the introduction way back 10 years or so ago. Since that time, it has consistently been our best-selling model. But a lot has changed in the industry, and a lot has changed in terms of consumer preference for the vehicles that they purchase and what they want in terms of the content of their vehicles as well. So what we've done with this vehicle is it's carried over the strengths of CX-5, right? Again, I've referenced the driving dynamics, that Jimba Atai feel that Mazda is known for, the bold design language that we have as well, the craftsmanship and content that CX-5 has. In fact, some of your peers just this morning were referencing how well contented this vehicle is, and that's been a key to the success that we've had previously as well. What's maybe the new news part of it, and perhaps not maybe, but is the new news part of it is, you know, I've referenced things are getting bigger in our life in general. So we've expanded the wheelbase and we've expanded the utility in terms of rear seat legroom, in terms of cargo capacity, and the rear of the vehicle as well. The other big news is the in-car technology. So the introduction of a new HMI system that has been receiving very favorable feedback from our existing owners and, frankly, your peers here over the last couple of days as well. So we feel like it's building off of a very strong foundation with a model that for the last 10 years running has been our best-selling model. So we're very optimistic about the impact it's going to have and the market reception that our owners will have to this vehicle.
Okay. In addition to the infotainment system that you mentioned, which is now a Google built-in system, one of the other big changes this time is, at least later this year, is going to be the addition of the SkyActiv-Z hybrid system. That's new. Is that system, I mean, right now you have a Toyota-based system in the CX-50, but is the SkyActiv-Z hybrid, is that a completely in-house Mazda developed system, and what can you tell us about that particular system?
Yes, is the answer to your question. It is a proprietary. It is a Mazda-based hybrid system that will be coming shortly in this CX-5 that we're introducing here today. The way that I would characterize it is: look, the market is moving towards hybrids. Frankly, at a you know, a pretty decent clip overall. So the relationship and the partnership that we have with Toyota offers a great opportunity for us with CX-50. It offers the efficiency, the range, and the MPG that consumers are looking for. What is unique about the system that we're developing, I would call it a driver's hybrid, that all of the things that people desire and expect with a hybrid system in terms of, again, the efficiency, the MPG, all of that, is there, plus the torque and the driving dynamics that customers want from Mazda. So it really offers the best of both worlds in that regard. So we think the combination of those two hybrid systems is really going to be powerful for us with our future product portfolio.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to an opportunity to try that one out when it's available. You mentioned earlier affordability. One of the bigger challenges across the industry right now. But looking at the sales numbers, you know, even though overall sales are up, the sales of the 3 and the CX-30, which should be playing an important role right now in addressing that affordability challenge, they both had significant sales declines in 2025. Mm-hmm. What can you comment at all on what led to that? I mean, was it a supply issue in terms of what you're able to get? Was it perhaps constrained because of tariffs, or was it just a decline in demand, or a combination of those factors?
It's a bit of a combination of those factors. So again, back to just how dynamic the industry's been over the last few years, but especially in the last few months as well. Specifically on Mazda 3, what I would say, in the last 3 to 4 months, we've made, I wouldn't say a renewed effort, but we've been leaning into Mazda 3 for the very reason you mentioned, the affordability opportunity there. And we've seen solid double-digit month-over-month growth over the last few months with Mazda 3. So we had to make some business decisions about our manufacturing footprint. Mazda 3 is now sourced for us out of Japan, so it represents a better opportunity for us. So, as I just talked about, the month-over-month gains that we've been able to realize in the last 3 months, we expect to carry that over into 2026. And our overall expectations for Mazda 3 will be up significantly. CX-30, our business is stabilized there. You know, that's obviously produced in Mexico, so it comes with some implications in terms of, you know, the tariff opportunity there. But we feel like when we look at the outlook for 2026, the combination of our continued growth with CX-50 and CX-90, the introduction of this all-new CX-5, and then the additional momentum that we're picking up with Mazda 3, we think we have a good blend of the portfolio that will fuel our growth, but also present opportunities, especially around affordability in the marketplace. The other thing I would say on the affordability side would be, we had our best year ever in terms of our certified pre-owned volume. So that clearly is an opportunity to put new owners into the Mazda brand, retain existing Mazda products in the network as well. So there's significant business value. It also protects your residual values as well. So that kind of full circle benefit of things presents an opportunity around that affordability challenge that's also in the market. One final point on affordability, and this gets to, I think, your first question as well. What we think we do better than just about any other brand is how we content the vehicles. So you're getting value at a really competitive price point. So it's all the things that are unique to Mazda, with significant level up content and features, as well as the safety story that we can tell that many other brands would be envious of.
Yeah, I mean, definitely agree on the value side. CX-30, for example, starting under $30,000 with standard all-wheel drive, You know, it's a great option for a lot of people. My daughter owns one. She bought one. Loves. You know, she's had that for a couple of years now and loves it. I guess one last thing. Mazda. Despite the growth that you've had over the last decade, it's still a relatively smaller brand compared to a lot of your competitors. Mm-hmm. Is there an opportunity, or does it make economic sense for a brand like Mazda to produce more vehicles in the U.S. to combat tariffs? Would you have to do it through partnerships such as your partnership with Toyota on CX-50 production? What do you see as the opportunity there?
Yeah, great question. In the near term, we have upside opportunity with the Alabama plant. So production capacity there is 150,000 vehicles. Right now we're approaching 130. I think we're at about 132,000 in terms of the production footprint that we'll realize this year. So we still have nearly 20,000 units of upside in that regard. We're making decisions in terms of how and where and what we're building where. In terms of the growth expectations, our plan for this year is to set an all-time sales record. I mean, the industry itself is, depending on who and when you look at the latest forecast, going to be down slightly, or if you look at one other, I think the range has been 15.6 to 16.3. I'd like to think that the approach we're taking this year is somewhat conservative. We're projecting about 425,000 vehicles sold this year, which would be our best year ever. We've only exceeded 400,000 twice in our history, and it's been the last 2 years. If I project out towards 2030, our expectation, would be that we're beginning to crest 500,000 vehicles. So, steady growth is on the horizon for us. It'll be fueled by the portfolio that we have in place, some of the actions that we're taking in the marketplace as well. But in the near term, to come back to your question about manufacturing footprint, I would say over the next 18 to 24 month horizon, MTM will serve us well. We'll get to that 150,000 units capacity. And then as we project out for continued growth, 500,000 and beyond, we'll probably have to make some business decisions relative to manufacturing footprint, but nothing that, we're ready to announce here today.
Is there potentially opportunity to expand the capacity that you have in Alabama?
Again, not in the near term.
If the business case makes sense.
Like anything, if the business case makes sense, you look at alternatives, and if you're already invested and have a presence there, you could build off of that. But I would be speculating and projecting out there. I mean, we need to optimize what we have in place right now. And for the next couple of years, that represents a stable footprint and opportunity for us to try to leverage.
All right. Any final thoughts you want to share with the listeners about Mazda and where it's going in the next few years?
Yeah, I just want to reiterate the excitement that we have about the new CX-5. Again, it's been our bestseller. We think we've enhanced it significantly for what the marketplace is looking for today. I do want to make one point. We received some great news last week. We were recognized by Consumer Reports, a particular recognition where they awarded us the safety verdict, where our brand and our models represent, in terms of accident avoidance and occupant protection, more than any other brand in the industry. So that applies to this new CX-5 that we're introducing right now, but every model in the Mazda portfolio as well. So beyond the IIHS recognition that we've benefited from and are best in class in that regard as well, we were particularly pleased with the recognition, the accolade that Consumer Reports provided last week.
Well, I don't think my particular Mazda fits within that scope, but it's definitely a car that I have no intention of ever letting out of my hands. I own a 1990 Miata, so.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations and thank you for that.
Thanks. Well, thank you so much for your time, Tom. I really appreciate it.
Sam.